Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Plato, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers, available on the web. This is episode 2, so introduced roughly to Plato, student of Socrates, and Socrates is sort of alive in sort of half fiction in Plato's contemplation, his various books. I must admit, I thought, I still remember reading The Republic a long time ago. It was a slim volume, but now I look at it, it's 400 pages long, so that will be a tour de force on the of podcast to actually do that. And I've been informed that I've got to been fine-tweaked, do podcasting, a bit of exercise, podcasting, a bit of exercise, social stuff, really mix and dice it up. There's Plato's, I suppose, his idea of forms, and his, which is the idea of an ideal abstract sort of thought. And so it's really rather beautiful because he's actually trying to explain what an abstract thought is in a very concrete way. It's a sort of semi-concrete way where people cannot understand abstract whatsoever. So someone's trying to explain to you what an abstract, what is goodness as a general quality, what is it? And if someone really doesn't understand anything abstract, this is his attempt to do it. The other thing is the way that he's not constructing a complete superstructure as Aristotle did. He's constructing an opening, investigation, a co-witness. He's a co-witness with him. Now, we're going to read now to Plato's section 5, something called Plato's Indirexus. Oh, you can hear, the background? There's a kookaburra just above here, and of course it's not doing a happy song, it's been harassed by these noisy miners that are all surrounding him, or her up the tree. I can't tell whether it's male or female from this distance. Plato's Indirectness. Socrates, this should be kept in mind, does not appear in all of Plato's works. So Socrates is his teacher, and Plato, he appears in a work? Well, he's appeared and given a voice, a dialogue. He makes no appearance in the Laws, and there are several dialogues, Sophists, Statements, and Terms, in which his role is small and peripheral, while some other figures dominate the conversation, or even in Timus and Critias presents a long and elaborate continuous discourse of their own. Plato's dialogues are not like a static literary form, nor do his topics vary. Not only do his speakers vary, but the role played by the questioners, by the questions and answers, is never the same from one dialogue to another. Now, if I really want to say, if I can really advertise the Socratic app, which I have assisted with it, I'll make sure. I've just got to look here that I've got everything under control, and I'll make sure that it retrospectively points to the appropriate app. So the placement of the app requires a little bit. Okay, let's talk about this. Symposium, for example, is a series of speeches. There's also lengthy speeches in the Apology, which is defense. Maxenus, Protagoras, Crito, Phaedrus, Timus and Critias. In fact, one might reasonably question whether these works are properly called dialogues. But even though Plato constantly adapted, quote, the dialogue form, a commonly used term, and conveniently enough, so long as we do not think of it as an unvarying unity, to suit his purposes, it is striking that throughout his career as a writer, he never engaged in a form of composition that was widely used in his time and soon to become the standard mode of philosophical address. Plato never became a writer of philosophical treatises, even though the writing of treatises, for example, on rhetoric, medicine, geometry, was common practice among his predecessors and contemporaries, which is Aristotle is completely treatised. The closer we've come to an exception to this generalisation is the seventh letter, which contains the belief section in which the author Plato, or someone pretending to be him, commits himself to several philosophical points, while insisting at the same time that no philosopher will write about the deepest matter, but will communicate his thoughts only in private discussions with selected individuals. As noted above, the authenticity of Plato's letters is a matter of great controversy, and in any case, the author of the seventh letter declares his opposition to the writing of philosophical books. Wow. Whether Plato wrote it or not, it cannot be regarded as a philosophical treatise, and its author did not wish it to be so regarded. In all of his writings, except for the letters, if any of them are genuine, Plato never speaks to his audience directly in his own voice. Strictly speaking, he does not himself affirm anything of in his dialogues. Rather, his interlocutors of his dialogues are made by Plato to do all the affirming, doubting, questioning, arguing, and so on. Whenever he wishes to communicate to us, is conveyed indirectly. Isn't that beautiful? And this is one of the things that I do, just speaking recently, this direct crisis management, this direct, I've been offended, here's a crisis, here's the punishment, this sort of, the view of a tyrant is like this. Section 6, can we know Plato's mind? This feature of Plato's work raises important questions about how they are to be read, and has led to considerable controversy among those who have studied his writings. Since he does not himself affirm anything in any of his dialogues, we can never be on secure ground in attributing a philosophical doctrine to him, as opposed to one of his characters. Yes. He does have, obviously, philosophical frameworks which the characters work in. Did he himself have philosophical convictions? And can we discover what they were? Are we justified in speaking the philosophy of Plato? Or, if we attribute some view to Plato himself, are we being unfaithful to the spirit of which he intended the dialogues to be read? Is his whole point in refraining from writing treatises to discourage the readers of his works from asking what the author believes and to encourage them instead to simply consider the plausibility or implausibility of what his characters are saying? Which is, you know, I don't know, we're such suckers for Aristotle. Is that why Plato wrote dialogues? If not for this reason, then what was his purpose in refraining from addressing his audience in a more direct way? There are other important questions about the particular shape of his dialogues take. For example, why does Socrates play such a prominent role in so many of them, and why, in some of these works, does Socrates play a smaller role or none at all? Once these questions are raised, their difficulty acknowledged, it is tempting in reading Plato's works and reflecting upon them to adopt a strategy of extreme caution, rather than commit oneself to any hypothesis about what he is trying to communicate to his readers. One might adopt a stance of neutrality about his intentions, and confine oneself to talk only about what he said in his dramatis personale. I don't know what that means. One cannot be faulted, for example, if one notes that in Plato's Republic, Socrates argues that justice in the soul consists in each part of the soul doing its own, whatever that means. It's equally correct to point out that other principal speakers in that work, Galkon and Adeimantus, except the arguments of Socrates, gives for that definition of justice. Perhaps there is no need for us to say more. To say, for example, Plato himself agrees that this is how justice should be defined, or that Plato himself accepts the arguments of Socrates, gives in support of his definition. And we might adopt the same minimalist approach to all of Plato's works. After all, is it to any importance to discover what went on inside his head as he wrote, to find out whether he himself endorsed an idea he put into the mouths of his characters, whether they constitute, quote, the philosophy of Plato? Should we not read his works for their intrinsic philosophical value and not as tools to be used for entering into the mind of the author? We know that Plato's characters, we know what Plato's characters say, and isn't that all we need for the purpose of engaging his works philosophically? But the fact that we know what Plato and characters say does not show that by refusing to entertain the hypothesis about the author of these works, is trying to communicate to his reader we can understand what those characters mean by what they say. We should not lose sight of the obvious fact. It is Plato, not any of his dramatis personae, his personal fronts, who's reaching out to a readership and trying to influence their beliefs and actions by means of his literary actions. When we ask whether an argument is put forward by a character of Plato's works, we should be read as an effort to persuade us of its conclusion, or it is better read as a revelation of how foolish that speaker is. We are asking about what Plato, the author, not the character, is trying to lead us to believe through the writing he is presenting to our attention. We need to interpret the work itself to find out what if or Plato, the author, is saying. Similarly, when we ask how a word that has several different senses is best understood, we are asking what Plato meant to communicate to us through the speaker that uses the word. We should not suppose that we can derive much philosophical value from Plato's writings if we refuse to entertain any thoughts about what use he intends us to make of things his speaker says. Penetrating into the mind of Plato and comprehending what his interlocutors liqueurs meant by what they say are not two separate tasks but one. And if we do not ask what his interlocutors means by what they say, and what the dialogue itself indicates, we should think about what they mean. We do not profit from the reading of his dialogues. I mean, God, is this a sort of religious saying? Such a flowery, there's an Australian word for this. Furthermore, the dialogues have certain characteristics that are most easily explained by supposing that Plato is using them as vehicles for inducing his readers to become convinced, or more convinced than they already are, of certain propositions. For example, that there are forms, that the soul is not corporal, that knowledge can be acquired by means of a study of forms, and so on. Why, after all, did Plato write so many works? For example, and there's this whole series of works in which one character dominates the conversation, often but not always Socrates, and convinces the other speakers, at times after encountering initial resistance, that they should accept and reject certain conclusions on the basis of the arguments presented. What I do want to say is that from studying Augustus, Saint Augustine, you can see that although I think this is really missing the point, my overall view, because that is how logic was run. That is how it's run. It is, you have a meeting, and once everyone agrees, you can't disagree. It's sort of you have a meeting and you come there with your arguments and you'd lose the argument and that was it. You've lost the argument. It's this very primitive way of going. We don't quite understand it fully here. I don't think they understand fully how the ancient world worked. Where you had no silent reading and you had a group meeting, and when the argument was won, it was definitely won. You couldn't budge from it. You could actually, if the crowd changed their mind, your mind was changed with it. It was the most amazing thing to see. The only possible way of answering the question is to say that these dialogues were intended by Plato to be devices by which he might induce his audience, for which they are intended to reflect on and accept the arguments of conclusions offered by his principal interlocutor. I disagree with this person. What the only plausible way, I don't think it really understands the culture of the ancient world. It is almost, it's sort of like, you know, how Sky News influences everyone and everyone listens to Alan Jones or what we call shock jocks. It's sort of like, this is sort of like a shock jock. You read a radio program and you convert it. It is noteworthy that in Laws, the principal speaker, an unnamed visitor from Athens, supposed that laws should be accompanied by preludes in which the philosophical basis is given as a full explanation as possible. The value of written text is thus explicitly acknowledged by Plato's dominant speech. It precludes an educated, a whole citizenry that is prepared to learn from them. Then surely Plato thinks other sorts of written texts, for example his own dialogues, can be served as executive function. Yes, but I think the way in which it educates, this person doesn't understand how the ancient mind worked. And it doesn't work differently, it just worked much more. You could have like it's beginning to rain ever so gently here, I have to get the last remaining sheet and pillowcase in. However, I could be in a room and there'd be 10 people around me saying it's sunny, and if they all voted it's sunny, I'd go, oh damn, it is sunny, oh shit. That's an extreme example, but you have a group of people meet and they would change their mind collectively. This does not mean that Plato thinks that his readers can become wise simply by reading and studying his work. If I can say that's how the army works, you put them together and you convince, and everyone gets convinced to go over the top and run up against machine guns. It does not mean that Plato thinks that his readers can become wise by simply reading and studying his works. On the contrary, it's highly likely that he wanted all his writings to be supplementary aids to philosophical conversations. And this is a beautiful idea, that he is writing as his, in Laws, he says you need a philosophical prelude. He is writing a philosophical prelude. Beautiful work. In his works, he, as Socrates, warns his readers against relying solely on books or taking them to be authoritative. They are, Socrates says, best used as advisors to stimulate readers' memory of discussions they have had. In those face-to-face conversations with the acknowledged leader, propositions are taken, arguments are given, conclusions are drawn. Plato's writing, he implies, in this passage from Phaedrus, will work best when conversational seeds have been already sown in arguments they contain. I couldn't agree more, and I think we are really going back to this ancient world by podcasting, is my overall view. I'm not putting it towards you, but there's just so many shades within shades here. So he thinks it's a prelude, and I'm talking to you as a prelude for your greater thinking about philosophy. I'm not telling you how to think, I'm just giving you ideas, just chatting with you. Socrates as dominant speaker. 16 minutes in, and I've got to really push myself. Do I have to push myself? I've said wind it back to 3/4 of an hour. If we take Plato to be trying to persuade us, in many of his works, to accept the conclusions arrived at by his principal interlocutors, or to persuade us the characters, fictitious characters, or to persuade us of refutations of their opponents, we can easily explain why he so often chose Socrates as a dominant speaker in his dialogues. Presumably, contemporary audience for whom Plato was writing included many of Socrates' admirers. They would be predisposed to think of that character called Socrates would have all the intellectual brilliance and moral passion of a historical person whom they have named, especially since Plato often makes special efforts to give Socrates a lifelike reality as him and refer to his trial or to the characteristics by which he was best known. Brilliant thought. This is true propaganda at its best. It's sort of like a spin doctor. He's dead. It's sort of like saying Bradman. You know, in Australia, we are the most highly regarded character is Bradman, and even children in kindergarten can tell you his score, 99.6. They'll tell the legend. They may not know what cricket is, but they definitely know Bradman. So Bradman is our Socrates. He's a cricket player. Shane Warne's probably not the same level. Furthermore, my memory's gone far out. The Chapel Brothers. In fact, I played cricket with the Chapel Brothers. Amazing. All three of them. Furthermore, if Plato felt strongly indebted to Socrates for many of his philosophical techniques and ideas, that would give him further reason for assigning a dominant role to him in many of his works. Of course, there are some more speculative possible ways of explaining why Plato often makes Socrates his principal speaker. For example, we could say that Plato is trying to undermine the reputation of the historical Socrates by writing a series of works in which a figure called Socrates manages to persuade a group of naive sycophantic interlocutors to accept absurd conclusions on the basis of their sophistries. But anyone who has read some of Plato's works will quickly recognize the utter implausibility of that alternative way of reading them. Plato would have written into his works clear signals to the reader that the arguments of Socrates do not work, and that his interlocutors are foolish to accept them. But there are many signs in such works as Meno, Phaedo, Republic, and Phaedrus, that support of the opposite direction. And the great admiration Plato feels for Socrates is also evidence for his apology. The reader is then is given every encouragement to believe that the reason why Socrates is successful in persuading his interlocutors on those occasions when he does succeed is that his arguments are powerful one. The reader, in other words, it's almost like reading Christian TV, and you turn on TV and you have to see this argument, and the rest of the audience says, "Yay, I believe." And some people that works. I don't think it works nowadays. The reader, in other words, is being encouraged by the author to accept those arguments. If not as a definitive, then at least highly arresting and deserving of careful and full positive consideration. When we interpret the dialogues in this way, we cannot escape the fact that we are entering into the mind of Plato and attributing him, their author, a positive evaluation of the arguments that his speakers presented to each other. And that gives me an idea that in aid to communication, sort of communication of a brand new idea off the bat is not much. I really should have a background audience that I'm talking to. Links between the dialogues. There is, and we're at 20 minutes in, oh God. There is a further reason for entertaining a hypothesis about Plato intended, what Plato intended and believed. And not merely confining ourselves to observations about what sorts of people his characters are and what they say to each other. When we undertake a serious study of Plato and go beyond reading just one of his works, which I'm going to bloody well try and do, we are inevitably confronted with the question of how we are to link the work we are currently reading with the many of other Plato's Plato is composed. Being, it gives me database software, cross-linking, doing a full military intelligence, you know, often in military, or I shouldn't say, in military, in any intelligence operation, you get a whole series of documents and you have to cross-link them and work out who the author was, what the author was doing, any stress words. You just go all the way through. So you just whack it to it. Military intelligence unit. Admittedly, many of his dialogues make a fresh start at their setting and their interlocutors. Typically, Socrates encounters a group of people, many of whom do not appear in any other work of Plato. And so, as an author, he needs to give his readers some indication of their character and social circumstances. But often Plato's characters make statements that would be difficult for readers to understand unless they had already read one or more of his other works. Sort of like watching a television series, Gilmore Girls, for example. In fact, I've watched half an episode of Gilmore Girls, and my brain's gone. There was some problem at school, and the mum was concerned about it. I think that's all Gilmore Girls, but here, it really is like watching Friends, you know, or Seinfeld. There's all this, basically, you know, when Seinfeld characters come in, the American laughter goes, ah, 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 ah. The characters come in, and then there's a big pause, and this person says something a bit like, Big Bang Theory. All of these things, you've had to watch a lot of them. A lot of people just like it, because the joke is a joke within a joke within a joke. I assume. It's just not very funny to me. For example, in Phaedo, Socrates says that one argument for immortality of the soul derives from the fact that when people are asked certain kinds of questions, they are aided with diagrams. They answer in ways that show they are not learning afresh from the diagrams or from information provided in the question, but are drawing from their knowledge of answers from within themselves. That remark would be a little worth for an audience who had not already read Meno. Oh, God. No, I don't have to read. Oh, God. I'm going to have to read the whole works of Plato. Several pages later, of course, scene later in Friends, Socrates sells his interlocutors at the bar, nonetheless, at what's the name of that bar? I can't remember. That his argument about the prior knowledge of equality itself, the form of equality, applies no less to other forms, to be beautiful, good, just, pious, and all other things involved in the asking and answering of questions. This reference to asking and answering questions would not be well understood by the reader who had not yet encountered a series of dialogues of which Socrates asked the interlocutors questions of the form, what is X? Wow, that's a real blow. Evidently, Plato is assuming the readers of Plato have already read several of his other works. What else is there to do in the ancient world except go out and battle and have a bit of Olympic game work and then be a slave master? And we'll bring to bear the current arguments of all the lessons that have been learnt from them. In some of his writings, Plato's characters refer ahead to the continuation of their conversations on the other day, or refer back to conversations they had referencely. Last Plato signals to us that we should read Theatrus, Sophist, Statesman sequentially. And similarly, since the opening of Timus, he refers back to the Republic. Plato is indicating his readers that they must seek some connection between these two works. So he's just pushing his books. I don't think he was making much money from them. Well, he could have been. These features of the dialogues show Plato's awareness that he cannot be entirely start from scratch in every work that he writes. He will introduce new ideas and raise fresh difficulties, but he will also expect the readers to have already familiarized themselves with the conversations held by the interlocutors and of other dialogues, even when there is some alteration among the interlocutors. This just speaks to me. Massive software doing diagrams connecting every person up with lines like a whodunit. Why does Plato have his dominant characters, Socrates and Eclectic Visitor, reaffirm some of the same points from one dialogue to another and build on ideas that were made in early works? If the dialogues were merely meant as provocations to thought, mere exercises of mind, there'd be no need for Plato to identify his leading characters with consistent or ever-developing doctrine. For example, Socrates continues to maintain over a large number of dialogues that there are such things as forms, and there is no better explanation for the continuity than to suppose that Plato is recommending that the doctrine to his readers. I think they got confused with religion and this. They're thinking, I don't know, this sounds really deeply confused. Furthermore, when Socrates is replaced as the principal investigator by a visitor from Ella, in the Sophist and the Statement, they're like block back into the movies. This summer, this fall, you have not lived until you have seen Terminator. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Sophist. And I've forgotten some American, Philip Ryan or someone, Jonathan Ryan, I've forgotten what they call. Jean-Claude Van Damme, the Statesman. The existence of forms continues to be taken for granted, and the visitor criticizes any conception of reality that excludes such incorporeal objects such as souls and forms. Yeah, it's like the form is the soul of an idea. I love that idea. The eclectic visitor, in other words, Ella. The visitor, in other words, I'm going to have to work out that. It's a fantastic word. Eclectic. Eliatit, visitor, in other words, upholds a metaphysics that is, in many respects, like the one Socrates is made to defend. Again, the best explanation of this continuity is Plato is using both characters, Socrates and visitor, as devices for the presentation and defense of the doctrine that embraces and wants his readers to embrace as well. Okay, there's only 28 minutes, but it's beginning to rain. I have to get in. But it's a bit like Hollywood today. It's like, a media empire. Okay, bye for the moment. They need Emmy Awards. Another story comes to a close.
It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.